I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Kelsey Riley.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 11:51, Tuesday, March 16th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. To all my old school wrestling fans out there, happy Stone Cold Steve Austin Day.
I'm Bill Finley, still just a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News, looking for a title.
I'm Kelsey Riley, international editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I don't know how I'm going to live up to John Green's helium party tricks from last week, but I'll do my best to provide some entertainment.
No one could ever live up to that. Yeah, maybe that's why he's not here. He's too high on helium this week. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Entries are now open for the March digital sale in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. The Keeneland Digital Sales Ring provides a standalone online auction accessible to buyers and sellers around the world. Keeneland is world-renowned for its live auction environment, and this online tool offers the quality experience you expect from Keeneland sales in an online format. For more information and to enter now, visit KeenelandDigital.com. All right, so last weekend, the much-anticipated showdown between Concert Tour and Caddo River and the Rebel didn't really happen. Concert Tour went to the front and ran away with it. I mean, it's kind of just ho-hum at this point. Bob Baffert has another top derby contender. It's just, it makes, not that, you know, he's necessarily doing anything wrong, kind of cornering the market on three-year-olds. It makes for a less exciting derby trail for me if there's one or two trainers that are dominating all the preps and going to Kentucky is probably an odds-on favorite to win with one of them. Nevertheless, I thought the ride on Caddo River was a little bit questionable. It's not as if they were flying up front. I would think drawing the rail, you have to be more aggressive than that with a horse who has never passed anybody before in his life, is clearly capable of running very fast fractions and staying on. So I thought that was kind of a mistake on Florence Giroux's part. Nevertheless, Joel Rosario was aggressive on Concert Tour, took advantage and took the bull by the horns and really never looked like he was stopping. So I don't think he's part of Baffert's A team necessarily. I think he kind of beat a bad field once Caddo River didn't show up. But nevertheless, he's undefeated, so it's hard to knock anything he's done so far. Just a couple other results from Saturday at Oakland. Cheat Airs the Devil was back in the Azari. We got a 99 buyer, ran pretty well off the layoff. She's a horse that I think a lot of people would consider a one-hit wonder at this point. In the Kentucky Oaks, she's won a couple other races, but has disappointed at some short prices. So it'll be interesting to see where she goes going forward. And then, to me, the star of Saturday was Swiss Skydiver. You know, it's great to have her back. It's great to have Kenny McPeak signaling that he's going to continue to be aggressive with her, ship her all around the country, shipped her across the country for her four-year-old debut. She didn't disappoint, got a 101 buyer. She's probably going to meet up with Monomoy Girl and the Apple Blossom at Oaklawn, so that's something to look forward to. We didn't really get that showdown in the distaff because Swiss Skydiver didn't get away all that well. I thought Robbie Alvarado had some kind of inappropriate comments after the race. I don't know if you guys saw on TV or on the Santa Anita feed. He kind of was poking fun a little bit at his past arrests for domestic abuse. So not a great look for him, but I'm not going to let that take away from the horse, who is the story, as she continues to just be exceptionally consistent and brave and willing to take on all comers. Let's just get some early thoughts from you guys on the weekend.
Oh, well, Joe, let's start with Concert Tour. And normally, you know, you say things and I'm like, yeah, I agree. So I agree, I agree. No, I don't agree. When you said you don't think he's part of the A team, I think he's part of the A team. And talking to Bob Baffert, he thinks he's part of the A team as well. You know, when I spoke to him yesterday, actually, from Ocala, you know, he was lumping him in with Life is Good so far as, you know, I've got some good horses and I've got some freakish horses, and Concert Tour is one of them. You know, if the Derby were run tomorrow, I think he would be maybe the third or fourth choice, definitely in the top four, something like that. You know, who did he beat? Nah, you know, Caddo River didn't run his race. He ran fifth. But keep me in mind, you know, remember, he ran third in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, and he was kind of up the track as well. So I thought Concert Tour was very, very impressive. What I do totally agree with you is the sameness of the story. And it's been not only just this year, it's been all the last several years since American Pharoah. It's like a story when he doesn't win. a Triple Crown prep. And if he doesn't have the favorite in the Kentucky Derby, you know, he's going in this year with a horse. And I totally agree with you that 2-1 on Life is Good in the Derby future wager is about the dumbest thing I've ever heard of in my life. But, you know, he's got the favorite in the Derby right now and probably the third choice, and then maybe the 7th, 9th, and 12th choice, something like that. Swiss Skydiver, yeah, you know, in the Beholder Mile, she was really good. And I really look forward to her running against, if she does, against Monomoy Girl in the Apple Blossom, because we were robbed of that showdown in the Breeders' Cup Distaff when Swiss Skydiver stumbled at the start. So a good weekend of racing. Whitmore comes back and runs second in the Hot Spring Stakes, trying to win it for the fifth straight year. At age 8, is he maybe finally age catching up with him? Well, maybe a little bit, but he's still good enough to run second behind CZ Rocket. So it was a very interesting weekend of racing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would actually agree with Bill on Concert Tour. I thought he was incredibly visually impressive throughout the whole race. Never really looked like being beat. So I think it's hard to do a whole lot more than that. He can only beat what's put in front of him at this stage. So I think it'll be very exciting to see where he goes next out. And I agree with you, Joe, on Cattle River. I think he was, I don't think it was a great ride. I think they didn't necessarily play to his strengths. And so I think he's still an extremely exciting horse that we'll see more from down the road. And absolutely agree with what you guys said about Swiss Skydiver. I think that was the performance of the weekend, and the thought of seeing her get to have a proper showdown this year, or hopefully more than one with Monomoy Girl, is something really to look forward to. And hopefully, you know, she dares the devil. She ran a strong race as well, like you said. So hopefully she's in that mix as well. And, you know, a couple other three-year-olds that we didn't touch on as well. Triple Tap, the half-brother to American Pharoah. He could not have been more impressive on debut there for Bob Baffert. So that's something to look forward to. And then Godolphin with another three-year-old last week in Prevalence, winning for the second time. And, you know, I would agree that it wasn't as probably visually impressive as his debut win. But again, he can only beat what's put in front of him. I think, you know, he was switching up running styles a bit, stretching out a bit in distance. I think the next time will be really telling for him.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, you brought up the other three horses I wanted to mention from the weekend. Triple Tap, obviously, was very impressive. Well bred. It sounds from Bill's story yesterday like Baffert's going to be a little more patient with him. He was able to squeeze Justify into the Derby, but I don't think there's any real incentive to do so now, especially when he has so many top class three-year-olds. He can take his time and try to point him towards the summer races if he really is that good. Bears Watching was also a horse I wanted to mention on Saturday at Gulfstream, half brother to Code of Honor. Is a really visually striking horse to look at. He dominated second time out at Gulfstream. So he's the three-year-old for Shug McGahee, who may develop later and be a factor in the second half of the year. But as for Prevalence, you know, it's I don't want to be the turn the punch bowl here, but I think I was expecting a little bit more from him in that race. You know, I understand he did miss a breeze because he had the fever, but supposedly he had come back and drilled two strong breezes at Palm Meadows before that race. I think if you stuck Truth Serum in Brandon Walsh, he would say he was probably expecting a little bit more. Now, I understand from his point of view, the race went, so that was step one. He won the race, that's step two. So now he can take his pick with the final round of Derby prep. So I think that, you know, it was kind of mission accomplished for him. But I just thought it was a workmanlike effort as opposed to something that was dazzling, as I don't think that allowance field was much better than the field that he drilled in his maiden race. But he does have a lot of talent for sure. He did learn to rate a little bit, like Kelsey mentioned. So that could be key for him going forward. He doesn't necessarily just have to pop out to the front. So he's most likely going to go in the Wood or the Arkansas Derby next. Brandon Walsh said there was an outside chance at the Bluegrass, but the Florida Derby comes up a little bit too quick for him. So he's definitely another one to keep an eye on. But I don't know, just maybe a little bloom off the rose when I expected so much better from him. He was 1-9 in that race. But obviously I'm not writing him off yet. We'll see what he does next out. So yeah, three-year-olds were other than Swiss Skydiver, three-year-olds I think were really the story of the weekend. And yeah, like I'm not dumping on Concert Tour. He's done everything he's been supposed to do so far, but I don't know, just figure-wise, I don't know that he matches up to the top echelon of the three-year-olds right now, but Time will tell. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning multiple greatest stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. Okay, so this news came out yesterday about mid-afternoon. Bill followed up on it and did a story in today's TDN about it. A lot of NHPBA, National Horsemen's Protection and Benevolent Association.
Yep.
All right. It's like the police unions. That's how I remember it. So a bunch of their affiliates in different states have filed a federal lawsuit to try to stop the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act from coming into being. It was notable that the four major states, four biggest racing states, New York, California, Kentucky, and Florida, their horsemen's associations did not join onto this suit. It was mostly the relatively smaller state horsemen's associations. Now, I have a lot of thoughts on this. I'm sure Bill does too. I don't know what the legal basis is for this suit. I'm not a constitutional law expert, but I don't see any reason specifically why the government can't be tasked with regulating horse racing and having this authority that they're planning to have. I think this is the perfect entity and perfect segment of the economy and business for the government to regulate. I mean, usually it happens when you have proven over time that you are insufficient in regulating yourselves. Like, I think that that's happened in the past, you know, with banks. When banks go under, the government steps in and there's nationalization. Like, this is such a small thing that it's not as if, you know, the Congress is going to be, you know, nitpicking and, you know, moving things around about horse racing. They're appointing people who are qualified theoretically to oversee horse racing. And the biggest deal to me was, you know, they're talking about the authority. Now, for those who are not up on the law, the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act is going to appoint this 9-member authority that's going to be in charge of regulating the sport, which I agree with. The idea that it's a little murky, who is going to be picking these people? Who are these people going to be? What conflicts of interest might they have? I agree that there is a little bit of there should be a little bit of consternation about that. However, the biggest part of HISA is the drug enforcement and USADA coming in and being in charge of making uniform drug policy in racing, which is something that is extremely necessary. I noticed that, you know, in the releases yesterday, they didn't mention anything about Travis Tiger and USADA and drug enforcement. It was all focused on this one authority. And I think that that is telling, that means they know it's a bad PR look to be against uniform drug policy. So I think that that's what they're suing against, but that they don't want to mention that because they know that that's not going to look good. And, you know, they're kind of the lone voice right now against this and against cleaning up the sport, which I think puts horsemen's groups on an island. And like I said, it's not all of them. Mark Cassie had some good quotes in Bill's story saying they sure didn't ask me my opinion, Arthur Hancock as well. This is just something that I think is counterproductive. I don't think it's going to succeed in stopping the bill from being enacted. However, the court proceedings might delay the start of it, of when it becomes, you know, in effect, which is already pretty far in the future, which is already July 2022. So we're already waiting another 12, 13 months for this thing to take effect. And this might push it back even further. And it's such a bad PR look, I think, to be, you know, united against drug reform in racing when almost everybody has now gotten on board and realized that we need it. I'll toss it to Bill now.
I'm ready to go into a Bianca-esque rant here about this. I mean, when my head stopped exploding and I put all the pieces back together yesterday, I had a lot of thoughts. And some of you already mentioned, Joe. Whether or not this is a valid lawsuit or not, I have no idea. We don't know anything about constitutional law, et cetera. But at the very least, I think this is going to tie this thing up for a while and perhaps tie it up for years. If they're really so inclined, we might still be talking about this 3-4 years from now that, you know, we got to get the last lawsuit out of the way. Then Travis Tiger can come in. And what really bothers me the most about this is, and you're again, absolutely right. They talk, oh, this is unconstitutional. Isn't it horrible? No, you're right. They don't want the sport cleaned up. Because why else would you be against this? You think any trainer in the Oregon HBPA is worried about the constitutionality of it, which one of the HBPAs that signed up for this, the constitutionality of the Horse Racing Safety Integrity Act. And what is the most asinine part of this is that nobody should be more in favor of Travis Tiger and USADA coming in than trainers. Because these guys that are suing the jockey club, the authority, et cetera, are, for the most part, I assume, honest people. Like, they got a quote from Ron Moquette about this. And there's a perfect example. There's never been any hint of scandal his entire career. Good trainer, seems like a good guy, doesn't win 35% like some of these guys do. And he's saying, I don't want this to happen. Ron Moquette should be leading the charge for this to happen, because how many times in his career has he been beaten by a cheater? 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 times? We don't really know. So this is so ass backward and asinine of the horsemen. They should be the ones leading the charge, because at the end of the day, when this happens, it's going to make the honest trainers and owners in this sport do better. And that's what this is all about. I don't know what they're thinking. This is just terrible advice. And it's not good for the sport. And it's not good for the horsemen. The horsemen are going against their own best interest here.
Well, exactly. Like I think you said, this is being put in to level the playing field for the trainers, the horsemen, the bettors. And I think back to when you guys had Travis Tigard on, and he was talking about when USADA came in to start policing cycling, and how, you know, when they began to crack down on things, people began to perceive it as a more open sport that, you know, they could compete in, that they could reasonably, you know, win at the highest levels. And how is that not a great thing for racing? That's what we need. We're constantly trying to attract bettors, owners, new people into the sport. So you know, this is the type of thing that we need. And also racing is in a position now where it's needing to prove, you know, as anything should, that we're doing everything we can to protect the safety of our participants, of our horses, of our riders. This is the next step in that process.
Yeah. And then, you know, I just wonder about the motivations of this, because I don't think that the horsemen's groups realistically think that this lawsuit is going to stop the HISA from being enacted. You know, like Kelsey said, they came in and started policing cycling. Like there was, you know, there was that kind of quasi-governmental approach to that sport. You know, the Congress got involved with baseball when, you know, all the cheating steroid guys were running amok. So I don't know what the basis is for saying that the government can't get involved in this kind of sport. But at the end of the day, I wonder about the motivation. It seems kind of like a cry for attention. And I think that maybe some of the horsemen feel like they've been shut out of this process. Now, I think that's nonsense, because this has been, you know, working its way through Congress and through, you know, committees for a long time. And, you know, it obviously wasn't going to pass until Mitch McConnell got behind it. But it's not as if this sprung up overnight and they had no chance to adjust or to influence policy. They had a long time to get on board and to, you know, kind of maneuver around and try to win concessions. So, if that's the goal, you kind of had your chance to do that. And if it's still your goal, which I think is reasonable to kind of, you know, exert what little influence you have for when the authority is seated to make sure that there are people who have horsemen's interests, I think there's better ways to go about it than this, which is very hostile and confrontational and kind of petulant, honestly, to try to stop this when pretty much the entire industry has coalesced around it. Like, the train has left the station, guys. Like, it's time to get on board. Like, this is not something that's going to stop this from happening. All you're going to do is make a lot of enemies and make it seem like you have something to hide and something illicit to protect. by doing this. It's not going to win you any friends or any influence when it comes to this law and its effects. And, you know, to me, the most important point about this is I don't think you can credibly at all make the argument that the current system is working, especially not better than a unified system would. And to me, that's the argument that essentially you would have to make if you're the horsemen's groups here, is that having 33 different jurisdictions and all these fragmented interests competing, which, let's be serious, what it leads to is cheating trainers being able to hop around and shop and go to different jurisdictions until they get caught. And then even sometimes when they do get caught, they get a slap on the wrist because it's too valuable to have their horses in that jurisdiction. You know, you can't possibly with a straight face look at people in this industry and say, that's working fine. Like, this is what we need to, the status quo is great and we need to keep it up. Like, that's just a ridiculous argument to make. And it's notable that they don't even try. I don't think they've even tried to say that, you know, this is the way that we're working right now and this is why it's working. Like, they don't even bother. It's just some weak, you know, half-assed argument about constitutionality. And, you know, it seems like a frivolous lawsuit. And from what Bill reported, it seems like it's the same people who file a lot of frivolous lawsuits these days, in the political spectrum. So, you know, unless you're going to make the argument, here's why our current system is better than a unified system would be, you really don't have a leg to stand on, because this thing has been needed for a long time in racing. Some kind of unification process, we're finally getting it. I would say 90% of people are super excited about it and ready to turn the corner and ready to start, you know, getting juicers out of the game. I mean, you guys really want to be the last ones standing on that side saying, nope, we got to keep the cheating trainers and the 33 different racing jurisdictions. I don't think that's going to be a good look long term.
Joe, you're 100% right about everything you said. And I also want to use the term status quo. So if you're not for HISA, you don't say what you are for. So they didn't say, well, we want, don't want HISA, but this is what we want. They didn't say that. You said, right, just this unconstitutional crap. So, but if you're against HISA, then you have to be for the status quo. There's only two choices. There's A or B. So let's look where the status quo has got us in this sport. Okay, we had about a year ago and a couple of weeks, 27 people were indicted for cheating, doping, et cetera. One person was already on their way to jail, and probably another 20 or so are on their way to prison whatsoever. We have a terrible problem with breakdowns and a bad perception, to the point where the animal rights activists are jumping down our throats and threatening to do their political best to put this game out of business. We have trainers all over the country that can claim a horse for $15,000 and improve it 20 buyer numbers in its next start and do so 45% of the time. We have hints that even the best races and highest levels of this sport are now affected by juicing trainers. The sport has never been more on a hot seat with the general public. Racing is not losing more and more popularity all the time. That's the status quo. And you don't want to get rid of that. You don't want to take all those things that are wrong. And this isn't a magic wand. It's not going to cure all our problems, but it's the far and away the best solution anybody has ever come up with to start working on horse racing problems, things that have to be worked out. Arthur Hancock told me if this doesn't come to be, horse racing's finished. I think that's a little bit too out there on a limb. I don't think horse racing is finished, but if we go in to the next 4 or 5 years and we don't have this bill passed, it's going to be hugely detrimental to the sport. And these horsemen are to blame. I mean, I can't even begin to understand what they're thinking.
Well, like you guys both alluded to there, it does seem as if the majority of the power brokers in the business are for this and excited about it, like Joe said. And it took a while to get there too. This has been going on for a number of years and was very divisive. And I think we saw, especially in the wake of what happened at Santa Anita in 2019, people were saying, okay, we need to come together. We need to make some positive change in the industry. So the majority of people in the business are behind this and excited about it. And so it is a shame to see it being hung up potentially.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a good point that, you know, Travis Tigard said this when we had him on, that these were kind of the perfect storm of scandals the last couple of years that got people on the same page. Like, this was not inevitable to get everybody in racing almost to support this thing and to support unified policy and to support governmental intervention. This was not a given But because of the breakdown to Santa Anita and then because of the FBI indictments last year, those twin scandals, I think, led to that kind of, you know, that cooperation and everybody getting behind it. It did not necessarily have to happen. So now you want to blow this up. You want to blow up this like kind of unsteady, fragile alliance that, you know, may not have happened and may not ever happen again in racing. That to me is shocking. And, you know, at the end of the day, they most likely know that this is not going to succeed. But the problem is there's so little time to waste. You know, this is not a sport that, you know, can just kick our feet up for the next 10 years and like, oh, we'll let it wind through the courts. And then if it happens, it happens. We're on borrowed time here, guys. Like, this stuff is needed. And I think you've seen the cooperation around the industry and the alliance behind it. You've seen finally a push to get something done on a large scale and to intrinsically, systemically change the game and not just nibble around the edges. And there's very little time left to do that and to continue having the social license to run horses. You have to prove that you're doing something to make the sport safer and to eliminate cheating to the best of your ability. And like Bill said, like HISA is not the be all end all. It's not going to solve every single problem in racing, but it's the largest step that I think any of us have seen in our lives to do that. So you got to have a good reason if you're going to be the only ones planting your flag standing against that. And to me, they clearly do not have a good reason. It's just a little petulant and it's a cry for attention, but it's the wrong kind of attention. That's my view. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtv.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
All right, so we have Kelsey on this week, our international editor, and I wanted to get her input and insight on the Gordon Elliott controversy because we had Emma on and we asked her what she thought the punishment would be, and she kind of nailed it that he wouldn't get a lifetime ban, he would get maybe a couple of months. I thought that was a little light. I'm wondering what you think, Kelsey, and what the European racing world thinks in reaction to that.
Yeah, I would have agreed with Emma at that stage. I didn't think that probably a lifetime ban was coming. I was thinking maybe a few years was coming. What ended up coming down was essentially a 6-month ban, which to me was far too light. And the thing that's been, you know, it was a very interesting week because there was a lot of talk about, you know, how it was affecting Gordon's mental health and how, you know, apologetic and sorry he was and everything else. But the thing that was extremely disappointing for me in the following couple of days after he received his ban from the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board was he came out with a statement about 2 days later saying, you know, another trainer will basically be stepping in, taking over operations for the duration of the ban, something that sounds, you know, rather familiar to us here in America. But, you know, it was disappointing to see that it's basically going to be business as usual at his stable while he takes a 6-month holiday. And then, you know, he put this message out on Twitter announcing this and then saying at the end of it, and this message was later taken down and a revised one put up, but saying Gordon will be available to assist the placeholder trainer. And to me, that showed that, you know, there was all this talk about how sorry he was, about how much he loves his horses, his mental health and everything else. But to me, that showed he just didn't get it. He didn't get that what he did. And as Emma, you know, really articulated very well last week, this wasn't a horse welfare issue. I don't think in the terms of no one was concerned about the level of care of the horses in Gordon Elliott's stable. You know, he's got, you know, some of the best horses in jumps racing in his stable. No one was particularly concerned about their welfare. But the black eye that this puts on our business To me, that statement that he put out just shows that he just doesn't get the terrible impact that had. So to me, that was incredibly disappointing.
Yeah, and it's a good point that you made about him being able to still assist with the stable. Like that's a major problem in American racing. Even when a guy does get suspended, which is extremely infrequently, you know, their assistant trainer just takes over in name only, and the program is still pretty much running the same. So that's an interesting point, and it's oddly satisfying to see another country, you know, slapping guys on the wrist for like major transgressions, because it's something that, you know, pisses us off to no end in America. But yeah, I think kind of we're all in agreement there that he got off the hook a lot easier than, you know, it looked like he was going to, especially with how big that controversy became. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more and more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the phenomenal TVG analyst and reporter, Christina Blacker. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's great to be with you today.
All right. So we're glad to talk to you. We're glad that you were able to squeeze us in. I wanted to talk about Hit the Road first. We have a lot of questions to ask you about your job and your life and Southern California racing, but Hit the Road obviously is a major, major horse for you and your husband, Dan. Can you just talk about the journey, not just with him to become a Grade One winner, but, you know, kind of over the past several years, maybe even 10 years, to get the barn to be at a place where it can have a Grade One winner?
Yeah, I think the thing about training that is interesting and also just so challenging is that when you start in this business or in any business, of course, you have to put in the time, the blood, sweat, and tears and try to progress things. But until you have a horse that really has some ability, I don't feel like a lot of trainers get the chance to show what they can do. And I think there are probably some trainers that have been training for decades and never get that opportunity to have a horse that is kind of Grade One caliber. And so from my perspective, you know, I've always believed that Dan would be playing at this level and that Dan had the horsemanship skills and the background and was putting in the effort and the hard work to deserve this kind of success. But until a horse of this ability kind of came along, he really hasn't had the opportunity to show people how he can train and manage a good horse. And I think, you know, one of the things that I'm most proud of with the way that Dan has campaigned him is to pull back and be patient when he's needed to. And he's never hit the road, has never had a serious injury, but there's been times when Dan really felt like he was going to get better with time. You know, at the end of his two-year-old season, he had already won some stakes races. He competed in the Breeders' Cup. It was time to kick back and just let him have a little time to grow up. And then he came back in his three-year-old season. And after winning the Oceanside, he had some really minor kind of bone bruising type stuff. Dan did all of the diagnostics that Santa Anita offers, and nothing serious was necessary to be done for him. But Dan really felt like he just needed some time. He could have pressed on. He could have probably run in the La Jolla and run in the Del Mar Derby, but he knew he was a horse that hopefully one day would win a Grade One and that would get better at 4 years old. And so now I think you're seeing that patience really pay off. And it's something that I know Dan really learned from Richard Mandela. He's worked for a lot of wonderful people, but he'll point to Richard as the horseman that really taught him the most in his time there. And I think taking that approach is what has enabled him to kind of cultivate this horse into what he is now. And hopefully the trajectory is continuing to improve. And, you know, you think about trainers like Chad Brown, he had a Grade One winner in his first season, and you see just how fast that career can skyrocket. And you look at Brad Cox, and, you know, Monomoy Girl came around a couple of years ago, and there it goes, like right up the graph, all of these horses, all of these owners come calling once they see what you can do. So fingers crossed, you know, this is the horse that really enables Dan to take the entire barn to the next level, because he's now proven what he can do with a good horse.
Hi, Christina. Thanks for joining us. And we spent a lot of time on this podcast this week and pretty much all the podcasts that we do, talking about racing's image and the perception problems that it has. I don't need to rehash this because you know very well everything that's going on, but you're somebody who behind the scenes has been doing something to combat this problem. Tell us about what you do with I Am Horse Racing, which you're the director of public relations, and what good and what accomplishments do you think it's done so far for the public perception and how people look at our sport?
Yeah, you know, the idea for I Am Horse Racing really came about right where I'm sitting around this table right here with a group of women that are, you know, interested and all have investments in the game. And we felt like a couple years ago when the safety issues were so prevalent at Santa Anita, there was so much coverage and so much local media coverage about what was going on. And in those reports was a real implication that people in horse racing and people that are training horses, jockeys, any exercise riders don't love horses and don't care about horses and are just not treating these horses with the respect that they deserve. And so what we wanted to do was to try to put something forward that was really educational and something that was out there to say, hey, no, you know what? Yeah, we recognize that there's a problem. We recognize that safety needs to be addressed, but look at these thousands of people across the country that are dedicated to these horses. Did you know that horses have an acupuncturist? Did you know that they have a masseuse? Did you know that there's a night watchman? Did you know that Jessica Pfeiffer could have gone on to a career in economics and she wants to be a jockey because she loves horses? You know, we wanted people to know that from the top to the bottom, there are people invested in this game because at the core of it, their passion is this animal and these horses. And so that was the initial kind of drive to start I Am Horse Racing. From there, what we've wanted to do is just to spread our reach as wide as we can and to reach as many people with these stories as we can. And social media has been great for that. One of the recent partnerships that I really believe in that I think has helped us a lot is teaming up with My Racehorse, because these are the people that we wanted to reach. These are folks that have, you know, an interest in horse racing, but they don't really know a lot about it. And so now we're able to flood them with this information. And they are also folks that are sharing it on their own social media channels. They might have a tiny piece of a racehorse, but then if they put it on their Facebook page and all of their hundreds of friends see that story, maybe they're interested too. And maybe the next time they see a story in print in the LA Times or a story on the local news, they might just take a step back and say, yeah, okay, I see the progress that Santa Anita is making, but I know that one person. I know those five people. I know that there are people there that are working hard, that are caring about these animals. Because I was personally kind of sharing the message myself. I would go to drop my kids off at school and say, yeah, you know, this is what's going on. But did you know that they've just put a $750,000 diagnostic machine in at Santa Anita? Nobody knows that. And so we really felt like education was going to be the first step. And then getting that message to as many people as possible would help going forward as well.
I think that's really interesting what you said there, Christina, about partnering with My Racehorse and getting the message out to a wider audience, because I mean, those people, those My Racehorse owners, they have an interest in racing, but they would have many friends in that who don't. And whereas I feel like I'm sharing these messages, but I think most of the people that I would spend my time around do understand horse racing. So it's probably not getting very far, but that leads me to a next step. Do you guys have any other partnerships planned, maybe with people even more on the fringe of racing, to just try and further push that message outside of our own industry?
Yeah. So right now, the other partnerships that we have are kind of with a lot of racetracks, in that at Santa Anita, they show our videos, you know, in-house all the time. Woodbine has been fantastic. They have been showing quite a few of our videos and helping us out as well in terms of gathering content. We've partnered with Bloodhorse a little bit. They do some advertising for us and help us out. We have partnered with the National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame. They put our videos on a loop in their lobby. And then we've also talked a little bit to the women at Amplify, who also have that same kind of mission of education, and they are trying to reach younger people. And so we're trying to work with them to get this message to younger people and to become a place where, you know, in Europe, and Kelsey, I'm sure you're familiar with this just from your coverage of their media, you can go on racingcareers.net or .com and find out if there's a place that is hiring. We are hopeful that as we develop our own kind of database and enhance the website, you can advertise a job on I Am Horse Racing, and you can search through a Google search engine and come to us and find how you can kind of branch in yourself. I really want to do a story on the Darley Flying Start course for the My Racehorse people, because I think there's probably a lot of high school, college kids in those families that might be intrigued and might want to learn a little bit more. So we're trying to reach as far as we can. The struggle that we face is that for all of us involved, for myself, for Brittany Erton, for Alexis Skarsky, for Molly McGill, this is our little passion project. It's not our jobs. And so we're, you know, flooding ourselves into our regular job. And then with every extra second we have, trying to gather this content and work on it as well. I'm hopeful that, you know, at some point we can partner with a really big racing company. Because as you say, I think a lot of our message was really racing centric for a long time. The My Racehorse has broadened our horizons quite a bit, but we need to go bigger. And that's the next step, hopefully. But like I say, it's just a matter of getting as much time towards it as we can amidst everything else going on.
All right. So this is a two-part question. You have to bear with me. We only have you for a certain amount of time. I think it's interesting for you that you have multiple insights and multiple ways to look at the industry from your time on television and your time involved with an up-and-coming barn in Southern California. So is there something on either side that you've seen from your experience on TVG or your experience with the Blacker Barn that you think can be done better in terms of presenting the sport, marketing the sport on television, and in terms of making sure, like you said, that guys like Dan have the opportunity to come up in the game and not everyone, not the horses aren't all dominated by a handful of trainers. I know that's hard. It's a lot. Two questions in one, but I was curious to get both of your perspectives on that.
Yeah, I think, you know, from a marketing perspective, I look at the team at First Racing. I look at Aiden Butler. I look at Nate Newby and all the folks back at Gulfstream. And I think that they are trying some new things in terms of gearing towards a younger audience. I think some of their videos haven't been as well received within the racing community, but I think you have to try, right? You throw a few things out there and not everything's going to stick. And I think they have to continue to kind of push the envelope that way. I think we really need to focus on the fact that people are always on their phones, on their tablets. You know, you have to get as much as you can quickly in that sort of digital form that can be easily consumed. We, for our videos at I Am Horse Racing, the ones that go on Twitter, we try to keep them at about a minute, minute 15, because beyond that, you kind of lose somebody if they aren't really invested. If you don't hook them quickly, they're gone. And so I think those kind of shorter bursts of marketing energy are a little bit more 2021. It's what people want right now. With TVG and with, you know, our association with FanDuel, we're able to reach so many sports betting customers now. And that, I think, has a possibility to be such a huge game changer moving forward. As states are making sports betting legal one by one, the databases are coming together from FanDuel and TVG. And the concept and the idea going forward is, you know, you might have all these folks that want to bet on a football game or they want to bet on a basketball game. But did they know that in the time of that timeout, in that 2 minute timeout, you can also bet on a horse race? And that's the plan. You know, you bring them in because of this other sport that they're passionate about. But there's always racing going on somewhere, no matter where you are, whether it's around the world. And for those sports bettors, I think as you make them understand 3-1 is 3-1, no matter where you're betting, and you don't have to wait till the end of halftime to make your money, you can make it right here. I think you're having an opportunity as these states make sports betting legal to really, you know, bring those gambling pools of folks together and create new fans of horse racing. And then you teach them about horse racing through the I Am Horse Racing type of banner. And hopefully you ignite a passion for it, not just the gambling side. You know, you have them find another way to feel invested in some of the people or the horses that are competing. And then as far as the actual like racing goes, it's so hard. When my dad talks all the time about back in the day, they would cap every horseman at 40 horses. And that really forced owners to distribute their horses to more trainers. And then in turn, you fill more races because the horses aren't always in the same barn. And then you clear those conditions. And it's a huge snowball effect. But I think because we don't have the interest that we did back then, it's really hard to do that. How do you stifle someone's business? How do you tell someone, I'm sorry, you can't send your horse to Bob Baffert because he has too many horses? You can't say that, you know, in a enterprise community. But I think to be a trainer now, and if you want to start, I mean, I look at Dan and he never stops. He's gone at 4:30 in the morning. He doesn't come home at lunch. He's on the computer. He's updating his website. He's emailing people. He's hustling. He's shaking hands. He's at the sale buying horses. He's doing deals. You've got to be all in to start in this business right now. Nobody's going to call you to train their horse anymore. And so I think you need people that are hungry and young, and not necessarily young, I shouldn't say that. You need people that are hungry and that really want it and want that success. And I think it's there. And I think that as we keep making these safety and integrity progress or progressions moving forward, if we earn back the trust of the public, of folks that might have enough money to become owners, of my racehorse people that then learn a little bit and also have money, and then maybe they want to dive into another syndicate, I think the success will come from there. I think we have to just try to share our message as much as possible, make the game as safe and as transparent as we can, and hope that as more people get their eyes on racing like they did in 2020, we can keep them around as fans.
So, Sam, let me shift gears a little bit here. You grew up in a horse racing family, but you've said in the past that you never paid much attention to the handicapping aspect of the sport. So you kind of had to have a baptism by fire. So tell us about when and how you got up to speed on the handicapping, which is a big part of your job. And what kind of handicapper are you right now?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I felt really out of my depth for a long time. I think when I first started at HRTV, and it was right out of college, a lot of people expected that I knew more than I did. And I really didn't. I knew about horses. I was always around horses. I was always riding. I was always in the barn. I had my own horse. I helped my dad when he was training, but I never read the racing form. I wasn't gambling. And so this was a huge learning curve for me. And I bought every book I could get my hands on and studied. I reported for years. I was probably reporting for 7 or 8 years. And so from that perspective, I was able to learn and to listen from my coworkers and not have to give my own opinion yet. And it really wasn't until much later, and I would say, honestly, in the last 5 or 6 years, that I felt like I had an opinion that carried enough knowledge and weight behind it to stand by it. And I use everything I can get my hands on now. I'm a real student. I've always just been someone that would research and read and bring everything together and then form my opinion. So I use Thorograph pretty heavily. I use Stats Racelens a lot now. I do all my chart work and kind of look at their percentages. I love their late pace figures and the equibase speed figures. I like to look at those, and I like to look at Thorograph and see if I see things lining up or if I see things that are different. I think I watch replays really well because my dad was a rider. That's one thing that I will gain the most from as I'm handicapping, because I look at the, not just the horses, but the riders too, and how they're kind of working with their horses. I've started using Trip Note Pros, which is kind of a new product, and they put out their trip notes on every horse in every race at Santa Anita and Gulfstream right now. And so it's something that I dedicate a lot of time to. I get up pretty early. I get up when Dan goes to the barn, and I spend probably 2-3 hours every morning trying to gather all my information together. And I also, as I'm on TVG, I'll give my selection, but I also just want to give as much information as I can. It's my job to do all that work. Maybe the person at home didn't have that time. They were doing their regular job, and now they're here to watch racing for fun. So I'll give you my opinion, but I also want you to know that I found all this other information, and it's up to you to make your own choice so that you feel strongly enough when you bet your own money.
Christina, this is almost going to build a bit on Joe's last question for you, but I guess just because you can look at it from a few different perspectives as well, and it's a broad question, so interpret it whatever way you like, but there's just been a lot of change, especially the last few years in the industry, in terms of ownership, looking at safety, all that sort of thing. Say, you know, a generation ahead now, what does racing look like to you?
I think it looks more accessible to that generation, at least I hope. And I think things like My Racehorse, you know, things like these apps, the migration of TVG, of FanDuel, and of all of the other sports networks that are doing the same to try and bring more people in, I think making it more accessible, and my dream would be to have racing feel more like it does in Australia, where everybody knows what's going on. You know, you can talk to the person that's driving your cab or your Uber, and they're going to ask you a question about horse racing. I would love for it to just become as accessible as possible. And whether that means going to the track. And I think that all of the extras that the racetracks are doing, once we can have fans back to bring people in, you have a wine festival at the track. Sure. If that's what's going to bring them there and then you teach them, then I think that's wonderful. I think we need to just make the day at the races as fun as possible to get as many people there, and then make the digital footprint of racing as broad as possible and everywhere, so that people aren't feeling like it's so foreign. I mean, I have our horse racing group of friends, but I also have a whole separate group of friends from the school or friends that I have from college. I'm the only person I know that works in horse racing in those circles. I would hope that more people want to get in, and whether it's from a marketing standpoint, advertising, merchandising, there's so many things you can do. It doesn't necessarily have to be hands-on with the horses, but just to bring as many people in as we can.
Christina, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate your insight and your answers, and keep doing great work in everything you're doing.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Christina.
Thanks. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Christina Blacker will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
Just a couple of things I wanted to mention before we sign off. OBS March starts today. Today and tomorrow, I think there's 580-something juveniles that are going to be sold. We don't usually touch on sales too much on the show other than with John, but I think this is a big deal because this marks the start of a new sales season. We go two-year-olds and then yearlings and then weanlings and broodmares. And I think that there is this kind of feeling of rebirth and optimism in Ocala for this sale. Katie Ritz did a good job on the preview of the sale in today's TDN. And I think that, you know, while the pandemic isn't over, clearly, I think we've turned the corner and it's starting to, the end is in sight. More people are getting vaccinated every day, millions of people, in fact. So I think, you know, that kind of optimism and that sense of near completion is going to trickle down to a lot of industries, racing included. So I'm interested to see what the results are like today and tomorrow. Now, I know that it's going to be affected by the lack of Korean buyers, who I think especially are one of the few contingents that support the middle market at these sales. But nevertheless, I think the market's going to be more bullish. How could it not be than last year's OBS March sale, which basically happened as the entire world was collapsing around it. So very interested to see what happens there. Good luck to everybody who's buying and selling. I'm sure John and Brian will be involved on the buying side down there. So we'll touch on that next week and see what the results are like with John. So that's going on today and tomorrow. And then this Saturday, not a huge weekend of racing, but this is the big closing weekend card at Fairgrounds. They have the $1 million Louisiana Derby. I think Mandaloon has been installed as the favorite there. They also have the Fairgrounds Oaks, which could have a few top Kentucky Oaks contenders clashing. And they also have the New Orleans Classic, the Muniz Memorial Classic, and a couple other stakes and Louisiana Bred Stakes at Fairgrounds. So that's where most of the action will be, and that's where our eyes will be this Saturday. Okay, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. Reminder that you can enter now for the Keeneland March Digital Sale, which takes place next week, March 23rd. I want to thank Bill Finley, Kelsey Riley, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Christina Blacker, our producer, Patty Wolf, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Danny Seiper. Thank you so much for watching. Please wear a mask and get vaccinated if you can. We'll see you next week.